Meeting of the House Judiciary Committee will now come to order. The time is now 1:28 p.m. on Monday, March 16th, 2026. We are meeting in the Grunberg Room, Capitol Room 120. The following members are present. Myself, Representative Gray, Chair. Let the record reflect that we do not have quorum to conduct business. I would like to recognize the staff supporting today's meeting. So Sophia Tenney from House Records, Kyla Tupo from the Juno LIO, and Dylan Hitchcock Lopez, my committee aide. Let the record reflect that we were joined by Representative Sarah Vance at 1:28 p.m. We have three items of business on today's agenda. House Bill 298, Legislative Ethics Committee and Proceedings by Representative Galvin and Representative McCabe. HB 250, Law Enforcement Concealing One Face by Representative Hannon. And House Bill 74, Crime Counterfeit Non-Functioning Airbags by Representative Tomaszewski. Our first item of business is House Bill 298. At this time, I would like to invite the sponsor, Representative Galvin, and the co-sponsor, Representative McCabe, to the witness table. Please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Appreciate the opportunity to be here. My name is Elise Galvin, and I'm representing District 14, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks, Chair Gray, and my name is Representative Kevin McCabe. I represent District 30, and it is an absolute pleasure to be here in front of your committee with this bill.
Thank you.
So thank you to the entire committee, and I look forward to interacting more with all of you in the future about this bill today. For the record, I also have the privilege, as you know, of working alongside my colleague, Representative McCabe, and my staff, who is behind me, Monica Schringendorf. And she will take this seat after I present so that we can all be forward in front of you. I would like to start by providing a brief explanation of the purpose of the Ethics Committee and what it does. The Ethics Committee is here to help maintain the trust that we have with the public. It's absolutely critical. It does this by establishing clear guidelines and consequences that legislators are expected to follow in order to act ethically and responsibly. The Ethics Act lays out the framework for what the public official should and should not do in order to earn and maintain public trust. They promote accountability, transparency, and ensure that there are consequences when those standards are violated. Ultimately, these laws help maintain integrity and order within the Alaska State Legislature. The Alaska State Legislative Ethics Act sets the rules that apply to legislators, legislative staff, agencies under the jurisdiction of the legislature, and the public members who serve on the Ethics Committee. It's important to note that the committee does not oversee employees who work in the executive branch of Alaska state government. The Select Committee on the Legislative Ethics has several key responsibilities. It helps legislators and staff understand and follow the Ethics Act. It issues advisory opinions to provide guidance on how the law applies in specific situations. The committee also reviews complaints that allege possible violations of the Act and maintains public records of required financial disclosure statements. What you will find in this HB 298 Ethics Act are many detailed provisions because the Ethics Committee is not a department with its own regulations or one that can establish and make its own regulations. So you're going to see a lot of details here. And these details provide greater certainty for legislators, for legislative staff, Ethics Committee members, and the public. The primary impetus for introducing this bill came from former committee members who recognized that the process allowing a complainant to remain anonymous was either unclear or not adequately addressed. They understood this was an oversight, and as a result, they, along with us, began working to revamp the ethics statutes. I want to make sure to mention that the member from the other body from downtown Anchorage did start working on this bill before we took it up. and she put a lot of effort into it.
For the record, would that be Lukey Gale Tobin, Senator for downtown Anchorage?
Yes, it is. Thank you. I'm grateful that I'm allowed to say names here. I want to be respectful of our rules. I'm not sure. They understood that this was an oversight. And as a result, they, along with us, as I said, we began working a revamp to really make sure we were more clear on all of the ethics statutes. So we offered to take up the bill to refresh the statute. And in doing so, it became clear that there were several additional areas that needed clarification and cleaning up. So that's why you have us in front of you.
And thank you. Really quickly, I'll just mention that we were joined by Representative Mina at 1:30 p.m., Representative Costello at 1:30 p.m., Representative Underwood at 1:32 p.m., and Representative Eichheit at 1:32 p.m. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Please proceed.
Fabulous. It's official. And you got here just in time for the best part. Representative McCabe is going to give us his historical insights on this work in the next slide. He's been present for much of this, and I want to make sure that he's able to also present this important context for all of you. And then my staff, Monica Schringendorf, will follow that up with a brief overview of the details of the bill. Because it is so lengthy, we want to make sure that we just give it to you in bite-sized pieces and then answer questions. And I will be excusing myself to go to the Finance Committee, but I know you're in great hands. So thank you so very much.
Thank you, Representative Galvin. Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Chair Gray. I appreciate being here. Representative Kevin McCabe from District 30, and I appreciate everybody showing up to give us a quorum. One thing that's really important before I get into a little bit of the history is paragraph 2 of the sponsor statement, which indicates that the Ethics Act is unusual because it does not have a department that enacts regulations, and so consistency reduces the risk of misinterpretation and provides clear guidance to the Ethics Committee as well as us and our staffers. So we are essentially promulgating the regulations through this statute. So it's really important to get this right. I'd also like to mention the current minority leader, Representative Johnson, as well as Representative Hannon, who also worked extensively on this prior to my tenure and prior to Representative Galvin's tenure. These regulations changes have been in place. They've been worked on for about 4 years, so maybe even longer than that. So I appreciate that. As far as the history of this, so in 1970s, in 74 and 75, the Alaska legislature adopted the Ethics Act, establishing conduct standards for legislators and staff. In the 1990s, we expanded on the rules, conflicts, lobbying, and disclosures, and we refined the procedures for complaints, investigations, and advisory opinions. So it took 15 years or so to get to that point where we could do that. Then in the late 90s, the modern structure arose with the committee composition set at 9 members, 2 senators, 2 representatives, 5 public members. The public members were changed over about then to be appointed by the Alaska Supreme Court Chief Justice, confirmed by a 2/3 legislative vote. So you can kind of get a sense of how this changed. In the 2000s, we had some increased visibility and reforms. There were several high-profile scandals, which we might remember. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say it, but the CBC, the corrupt Bad Boys Club, exposed some corruption and ties between the lawmakers and sort of forced a little bit more of a change to the ethics regulations. So in the 2010s, we got into the modern oversight updates, stricter conflicts, gifts, travel limits, resources use, and disclosures, and routine ethics training showed up, mostly due to a rise in internal complaints, and the committees were handling more cases, but they remained confidential and unless waived. But that was never really set properly into statute. So now we have the 2020 and the current roles and controversies. There were a number of investigations where the confidentiality was not maintained. So one of the things that you will see in this law is that we strengthened the confidentiality requirements and the redaction requirements to release certain reports, especially with respect to names.
While you pause, Representative McCabe, I will state for the record that we were joined by Representative Kopp at 1:35 p.m.
That's why I paused, to give you a chance to do that, Chair Gray. How did you know? So there have been a number of public members on this committee that have been there for a while. Their depth of knowledge and breadth of experience as we go through this was invaluable in putting these changes to the regulation together. And in fact, we had so many conversations with Ledge Legal, with our legal attorney, and with Ms. Joyce Anderson, who is the current chair.
Well, note for the record, is online and available for questions.
Okay, thank you. One thing I do want to, I would like to highlight and maybe acknowledge is that for a long time there was an administrator named Jerry Anderson, who is no relation to Ms. Joyce Anderson, who we depended on. I called that guy like twice a week when I was a freshman, asking him if certain things were illegal. When he passed away, it left a big vacuum. And frankly, it was a difficult time for this committee, and there were a number of things to that came to light because of his passing that we needed to fix. Many of those are also fixed. Thank you to Ms. Joyce Anderson for her input on that. But some of those things seem to be in the head of Jerry for a long time, but now they're on paper. So hopefully that gives you a little bit of a flavor of the history of the committee. I think it's important that we show through this committee and through the floor speeches and everything else that we are willing to regulate ourselves, that we are willing to set the ethics committee regulations into statute so that everybody can see and very transparent. And with that, I think Ms. Schwingdorf has got a sectional that she wants to read to you, if that meets with your approval, and then I'm available for any questions.
Thank you. Ms. Schwingdorf, if you would like to walk us through the sectional or the rest of the presentation.
I would like to say, Chair Gray, thank you. Just one more thing. It's very extensive. So Representative Galvin and I kind of asked that she abbreviate. If it starts to get to be too much, just give us the move along thing, and we'll try to abbreviate. I know Monica's very good at that.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Representative McCabe, but I think for the state of having it on the record, I think having the whole sectional is probably okay with the committee.
Perfect. For the record, Monica Schwingendorf, staff to Representative Galvin. Can everyone hear me okay? Okay, perfect. I would like to highlight the four primary revisions in HB 298 and explain the purpose of bringing this bill forward. I will focus on the following four revisions: operating procedures, ethics committee structure, current committee advice, and the complaint section. In front of you today is the full presentation along with a detailed sectional analysis. I will walk through each of the sections and highlight the most important points throughout these slides. HB 298 updates and clarifies several provisions in the Alaska's Legislative Ethics Act to strengthen transparency, ensure fairness in the ethics process, and updates and provides clarity to procedures for handling complaints and investigations. First, the additions clarify the authority of the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics to issue subpoenas and conduct investigations when reviewing potential violations. These changes ensure the committee has clear statutory language to effectively carry out its oversight responsibilities. In the sectional analysis, these additions are reflected in Section 1 and Section 8. Section 4 clarifies protections for whistleblowers by making clear that legislators or legislative employees who report conduct that they reasonably believe violates state law or the Legislative Ethics Act may not be subject to retaliation, harassment, or discrimination. Section 7 clarifies that the public members of the Select Committee are entitled to per diem and reimbursements for travel expenses under the same statute that covers legislators and legislative staff. Section 9 clarifies the advisory opinion timeline for the Select Committee by specifying that the committee may extend the 60-day period for issuing an advisory opinion. HB 298 in Sections 2, 6, and 26 clarifies and adds consistency to the Ethics Committee structure. This bill also removes public members of the Ethics Committee and committee staff from the jurisdiction of the Ombudsman Office to align with how legislators serving on the committee are treated. It also clarifies that the term public member does not include an alternate public member when determining the political makeup of the full committee. Additionally, the bill adds a statutory definition of a public member to mean a member or alternate member of the committee who is not a member of the legislature, ensuring greater clarity and consistency in the statute. The bill also updates code for current committee advice relating to the legislator's use of their title, as long as the legislator does not take or withhold action in exchange for a private benefit for the legislature or another person. Additionally, it clarifies disclosure requirements for gifts of travel related to legislative work, ensuring that legislators accept travel or hospitality for the purpose of gathering information on matters of legislative concern, and there is clear documentation and transparency. These additions are mentioned in sections 3 and 5. In addition, HB 298 clarifies and adds uniformity to the complaint section. Sections 10 through 25, along with section 27, explain the ethics complaint process. The bill establishes clearer timelines for acknowledging complaints, conducting preliminary reviews, and initiating investigations. These changes help ensure complaints are handled consistently while protecting due process for all parties involved. Lastly, the bill clarifies confidentiality requirements during the complaint process for the subject of the complaint, the complainant, and the committee process, thereby balancing transparency with a need to protect witnesses, maintain fairness during investigations. In summary, this bill aims to improve Alaska's legislative ethics framework and helps ensure the Ethics Committee can continue to uphold high standards of integrity and accountability in public service. Thank you for your time, and we are here to take questions, and Joyce Anderson is on the line as well to take questions.
Any questions from committee? I'll ask a question. Okay. So I'm looking at the sectional while you were talking through, and specifically looking at the changes to confidentiality. Can you just in simple language explain what the changes are to confidentiality?
Yes. Through the chair, for the record, Monica Schreendorf, there was a lot of cleanup language in the confidentiality area, and it was condensed into one whole section. And so the sections are from section 10 to section 26.
Thank you. I'll ask the question again. So we had a member of this committee, Representative David Eastman of Wasilla, who was waiving his confidentiality, which was then allowing people who'd made complaints to be reported. Is that still what would happen if you made an ethics complaint and then the person who was being reported on waived their would we then expose it all? I want to know what changes we've made for protections to confidentiality.
So I think I'll grab that one if you don't mind, Chair Gray, Representative Kevin McCabe again. So from District 30. Yes, that was one of the problems identified, was that by waiving by a person, a defendant, if you will, or a person, a complaint person, by him or her waiving their confidentiality in the old statute prior to this, it appeared like it waived the confidentiality for everybody. And a sharp lawyer took advantage of that, frankly, and broadcast the names of the people that had complained, that had filled out the ethics complaint. So previous to this, Jerry Anderson had very distinctly told anybody that complained, if you say a word about this to anybody, we won't even consider your complaint. And he did that through his sort of force as the director and as the way the previous statute was interpreted. Unfortunately, it didn't hold up, and there were some names released. This change prevents that by making sure that the complainant, the person that filled out the complaint, before the complaint is released, his name or her name is redacted. There are certain, and that is while it's going through the process. Once it comes out the other side, things change a little bit. But while it is going through the process, the person who filled out the complaint will not be subject to harassment or abuse from others or from or pressure or newspaper, news media, publications or lawyers. So, yes, we made that change for that specific reason.
Thank you. My other question is about subpoena, the subpoena powers. Is it correct to understand that the Ethics Committee is able to issue a subpoena without the signature of the Speaker of the House or the President of the Senate?
So thank you, Chair Gray, Representative McCabe again. I think that I will defer to Joyce Anderson for that. I believe that to be true, but my memory's a little hazy on that.
Ms. Anderson, can you unmute, place yourself on the record, and answer the question, please?
Joyce Anderson, public member of the Ethics Committee. And yes, in the past, the Ethics Committee was under the impression that we could issue subpoenas as it's stated in our statute. We were unaware of another section of the statute that did not give us that authority. And so that was pointed out to us. And so the committee felt that it was important for the committee to be able to issue their own subpoenas and not have them signed by the Speaker or the Senate President in the off chance that maybe either one of them was the subject of the complaint. And so they felt that that was something that needed to remain confidential part of the investigation. So the committee was very pointed that they wanted to be able to have the Ethics Committee have the authority to issue their own subpoenas.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Any other questions from committee? Representative Costello.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a statute of limitations on complaints and when they can be pursued?
Thanks, through the chair, Representative Costello. It's Representative McCabe again. I believe that it is 5 years, but I think that once again, Joyce Anderson is going to have to answer that one to be for me to be correct.
Ms. Anderson.
Yes, this is Joyce Anderson again, and yes, Representative McCabe, that is correct. It is within 5 years of the act.
Thank you. If there are no additional questions for the sponsor, for either sponsor or the staff, we will open the floor for public testimony on House Bill 298. Public testimony is now open. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify on House Bill 298? Seeing no one, I'll go online. Seeing no one online, public testimony on House Bill 298 is now closed. We will now set House Bill 298 aside and bring it up at a later date. Thank you so much to Representative McCabe and to Ms. Schwingendorf. Thank you,
Chair Gray. And if you don't mind, one more thing. I would be remiss if I did not mention Senator Gary Stevens, who also laid, put his considerable weight behind, I shouldn't say it that way, but his considerable authority as the president of the Senate behind getting this done. And he was involved in many of the areas. So, two senators from the other body and possibly even more before that. But this is a collaborative effort, and I really appreciate everybody's help.
Thank you. And thank you to Ms. Anderson for being available for questions.
Thanks.
Our next item of business is House Bill 250. At this time, I will take an at ease. Back on the record, our next item of business is House Bill 250. At this time, I would like to invite the sponsor of the bill, Representative Hannon, and her staff, Timothy Clark. Please come forward, place yourself on the record, and begin your presentation. At ease. a record. Thank you, Representative Hannon, if you would like to begin.
Hello. Thank you, members of the Judiciary Committee. I'm Representative Sarah Hannon, House District 4, which you are sitting in. House Bill 250 before you today would make it a crime for peace officers in Alaska to wear facial covering in the performance of their duties. I view it as a pro-law enforcement piece of legislation that promotes the public trust and the dignity and integrity of peace officers working in Alaska. When officers conceal their faces, they compromise transparency, communication, and the public's perception of accountability. Masks get in the way of de-escalation efforts and communication. They do the opposite. They increase fear and intimidation in already tense circumstances. Being unable to see an officer's expression can lead to misunderstandings and potentially needlessly tragic outcomes. Masks should not be used to conceal unlawful conduct on the part of a law enforcement officer. And if officers can't be identified, the risk that someone might impersonate law enforcement to commit crimes increases. From its original version to now, the bill includes several exemptions to make sure that we are looking at Alaska circumstance. It includes an exemption if the officer is working undercover. If the officer is wearing a shield designed to protect their face from harm without it obscuring their face. If the officer is wearing a medical mask to protect against disease or infection, or because they might be exposed to toxins, gas, inclement weather, or other hazardous or harmful environmental condition. It includes an exemption for officers to wear masks while outdoors if the temperature is at 32 degrees Fahrenheit or below. It includes an exemption for an officer wearing a helmet while using a motorcycle or other vehicle that requires a helmet for safe operation like a snow machine. It includes an exemption if the officer is participating in a tactical operation for which protective gear is required for the immediate physical safety. It includes an exemption if the officer is assigned to a special weapons and tactics SWAT team and is actively performing responsibilities of that team. There have been questions about the enforceability of a bill like House Bill 250. Even if the state can't compel federal agencies to follow this law, we want to make sure that current practices of some federal law enforcement are not extended to states. So it is preemptive in that no Alaska law enforcement agencies currently are using masking as part of their working conditions. But as we know, in some areas of law, the federal government can say, do you have a state law governing X, Y, or Z? And if you don't, then here's the federal standard that will be matched. And we want to make sure that the community policing standards that we currently operate under in Alaska continues. So this doesn't change the practices that Alaska law enforcement are currently operating under. It enshrines them into statute that that's what they will continue to be able to do. That is the crux of my presentation. And unless you have any immediate questions, I'm going to leave my staff to go through the sectional with you. I'm happy to take your initial questions, but I am in finance where we have a small topic before us today.
Thank you, Representative Hannon. Are there any questions for the sponsor before she leaves? Representative Eichheit.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Gray. I just want to thank the sponsor for some of these changes. I think it really clarified and made this a better bill. So before she leaves, I wanted to put that on the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Eichheit. Any other questions or comments?
Yes, I do.
Representative Kopp.
In the previous committee, Representative Hannon, what have we heard from leadership of law enforcement agencies? Have they testified on this?
Through the chair, Representative Kopp. The chief of police in the Anchorage Police Department, Chief Chase.
Case,
has spoken in opposition and says we don't need it, we don't do it, and it's not necessary.
So would you say he sees it as a solution, looking for a problem that it's not happening in Alaska? I mean, how is he putting it? Because you're mentioning federal, you know, I'm looking at the federal.
Because the question, people in the last committee especially, there was a lot of discussion of this is targeted at federal. There have been some other states who have attempted other laws that did target federal agencies, and federal district courts have said you can't do that. You can't target one group separate than the other. But if you are treating all law enforcement the same, if you're setting a standard for your law enforcement, that's likely enforceable. But there was a California law that was thrown out because it targeted only county and federal, but not state officers. And the judge said in their conclusion, because you're not including state law enforcement, but you're reaching down to county law enforcement and up to federal, we're finding that that was not an enforceable law. I don't want to project what the chief of police in Anchorage has said, but I will again assert, I am not saying that our major police departments are doing this. I want to enshrine a state statute so that they can't be required by a federal imposition of a standard that we don't. You know, usually when we talk about law enforcement in Alaska, a lot of conversations happen around de-escalation of situations, that most encounters aren't happening in SWAT tactical gear. They are happening with people in very tense circumstances. And I think that that ability to communicate and use facial expression is really significant in getting a message across, because we know that a lot of communication is nonverbal. And I think if it's masked, disrupts that, the ability to understand what's going on and why it's going on.
Mr. Clark.
Mr. Chairman, if I might add one thing to the representative's.
If you could place yourself on the record, yes.
Yep. Timothy Clark, staff to Representative Hannon. I'd just like to quote a very short part of Chief Case's testimony in the previous committee, where he said, and I quote, "Using officer safety or doctrine as justification for masking is not valid."
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Any other questions or comments for the sponsor? I have one. So it seems to me that yes, like seeing someone's face helps with communication. But I also feel like that there's a fear of like trying to like maintain anonymity. Maybe I'm wrong. And I know that there have been cases of officers not in Lower 48 not having their names visible. And I was just curious if you're open to requiring that names not be made hidden.
Thank you. Through the chair, to the chair. It's the first time that point has been raised in the course of the discussion of this bill. So I'm not opposed to it, but I hadn't thought of it as a problem. But it is similar in nature if federal agencies are having.
I think identity. To explain my point.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know any ICE agents. You know what I'm saying? Like, so in other words, like if their face is exposed to me or not, I don't know who they are. I would need to look at their name tag. And so this bill is saying, okay, well, you can't place a mask over your face, but you could not have a name tag. And, you know, I'm used to police officers having their names displayed.
And Mr. Chairman, my brain is a little fuzzy. We have had in the previous committee, the Police Standards Council talked about what was required to be certified as a police officer in Alaska by police standards. And I can't recollect where they were on the identification. But I know that repeatedly, much of the discussion is that in Alaska, our law enforcement have badges, have names, and as I like to say, we know them. They're our neighbors. They are our kids' Boy Scout sponsors. They're the Little League coach. They're the referees. So it is not at the community level a fundamental problem. But my concern remains that if we see a federal reach of we want states, if you don't have a preemptive law that says don't do this, don't give us your voter rolls, then you must. I want to make sure that we have set up to continue policing like we do in Alaska currently, with that expectation that most of our officers are our neighbors and known to us, and they are following standards that Alaskans are proud of. And I think they do.
Thank you. Seeing that, Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, so I haven't fully read through the legislative legal memo, but could you just talk a little bit more about how preemption would work in if there is a scenario where there is some sort of federal law that would require state peace officers to, or not require, but would allow them to conceal their faces?
Go ahead. I'm going to have my staff.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mina, one way to respond to that question is to bring up the ruling by a judge in California when suit was brought against the implementation of a very similar California law. And that judge struck down that law because of questions of, you call it equal protection or fairness doctrine, when one agency was not subject to the provision of the law, while local and federal agencies were. The judge, however, also ruled that the state could enforce a separate law that required all state enforcement, or that is all law enforcement, federal, state, and local, to display visible identification and to not mask. She further rejected Trump administration arguments that federal agents needed to be masked to be able to protect their identity from protesters who threatened to harm them or their families. She said, like many other public figures, federal officers face risks that, but that these harms are the result of criminal behavior and already subject to protections for those officers. But in essence, the judge did not believe that a supremacy doctrine applied to her her decisions in the case. And there are, you know, instances in which the degree to which a state might try to guide the behaviors and practices of federal agencies does not reach the level of preemption.
Thank you. And through the chair, if I can just comment, and while you were answering, I also was looking at the legal memo, and it seems that there is a bit of ambiguity right now how preemption would play with federal executive or administrative orders. So thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Seeing none, thank you, Representative Hannon and Mr. Clark. We will now set HB 250 aside and bring it up at a later date.
Thank you. Thank you for your time today.
And we'll go at ease while we set up for the next bill. back on the record, we have before us, back in front of the committee, House Bill 74. I would like to invite the sponsor of the bill, Representative Tomaszewski, and his committee aide, David Goff. Please come forward, place yourself on the record, and give us a refresher on House Bill 74.
Thank you, Chair Gray and the Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Representative Frank Tomaszewski, represent East Fairbanks area. And with me is my staff, Dave Goff, and he is going to give the brief recap of the airbag bill.
Okay. For the record, my name is David Goff, staff to Representative Tomaszewski, and HB 74 is the defective airbag bill, which is a bill that is presented to illegalize the import and the installation of defective or non-functioning airbags into automobiles. And that's after they have been deployed in the past. There's been a lot of bags that have been brought into the country and sold on either eBay or other marketplaces that can be installed in vehicles, but they're not functioning airbags. And people buy the cars believing that they have a functioning airbag for their safety system, and they find out they're not. This makes it illegal to knowingly install an illegal airbag or a defective airbag, and makes it a felony. So,
thank you, Mr. Goff. It is my intent to adopt a CS as the committee's working document. Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that the committee substitute for House Bill 74, Work Order 34-LS0455-N, be adopted as the committee's working document.
I will object for the purposes of discussion. I would now like to invite my committee aide, Dylan Hitchcock-Lopez, to come forward and walk us through the changes in the committee substitute.
Good afternoon. For the record, Dylan Hitchcock-Lopez, Committee 8. So the committee substitute version N builds on the previous bill, but then builds out a little bit from it. So Section 1 is new from the previous version, and it amends the statute to require registered vehicle dealers to inspect used vehicles prior to sale, and it imposes civil penalties to be established by regulation for failure to inspect. Section 2, which is the heart of the existing bill or the previous version, defines the crime of airbag fraud. So the CS expands the definition to include the intentional sale, lease, or trade of a vehicle when the seller knows or should have known that the vehicle does not comply with federal safety regulations or has a counterfeit or non-functioning airbag. It also takes the enumerated exceptions in the previous bill version, and instead of having enumerated exceptions, it just creates a general safe harbor provision that protects all sellers who provide written disclosure. It removes the subsection on civil liability and the duty to disclose because those have been superseded by the new Section 1, which does create an affirmative duty to disclose. And it broadens the definitions of non-functioning and counterfeit airbags. It also enhances the crime to a Class B felony if the criminal conduct results in the death of another. And then Section 3, which is also new from the previous version, adds a chapter to impose affirmative disclosure requirements on motor vehicle sellers related to whether airbags have been replaced. And if the seller is an insurance company, if they've been deployed and the vehicle declared a total loss. So the overarching purpose here is just to build on the concern, but strengthen some of the protections for the general public and to sort of streamline the safe harbor provisions while also stiffening the penalty for sort of knowing violations of the law when a death results.
Are there questions for my committee aide? Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, I don't know if this is appropriate for Mr. Hitchcock-Lopez or perhaps the bill sponsors, but do we know if motor vehicle sellers already do disclose whether airbags have been replaced?
Does the bill sponsor have any information on that? I don't have that information through the chair to Representative Mina.
Okay. Thank you.
And it looks to me that the sponsor staff also does not have that information. So I think we'd have to defer to perhaps the department.
For the record, David Goff, staff to Representative Tomaszewski, the only thing that I would say when it would be inspected is if it's a certified pre-owned car, that would be part of that check and testing on the vehicle. But as far as the other vehicles, typically I see them listed it as is. And so I would presume, but I don't know.
Okay. Thank you.
I'll just follow up on that, that one of the problems that I felt in the previous bill was that this bill also includes that you can give in writing, this airbag was replaced. You know, you can sort of like do your duty and say, you know, there is a new airbag in this. Because I believe before there wasn't really any way, like if you owned a vehicle and you weren't sure, like you had no way of being able to sell it. And so this was our attempt to try to create a way for people in Alaska, maybe in rural Alaska, to be able to sell a vehicle when they're unsure about the legitimacy of the airbag in a vehicle that maybe they bought used. Representative Eichheit.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, I'm looking at Section 1. What is the... I'm just wondering if there's been an attempt to find out what the average cost of the specified dealer or certified dealer inspection would be. I have my own intuitive idea since I work on vehicles, but I work on vehicles because it costs money to have others work on them professional. So can you just give the public an idea what that inspection would cost? A range is fine. I'm thinking Anchorage market, the largest market in Alaska.
Thank you. Through the chair. So the way that Section 1 is phrased, it just requires that the registered motor vehicle dealer conduct a reasonable inspection. I don't think that the statute as written requires some sort of specific kind of inspection that would, like a third party inspection. So I don't know that there would generally be any cost associated. It would be part of the cost of doing business. But I may have missed the question, Representative Eichheit. If so, I apologize.
A follow up. I think to clarify, is this only apply to registered dealers or does it apply to private sales? Like, for instance, if I sell you my vehicle, a private sale to a private person must. Under this new CS, would it have to be inspected by a registered dealer?
Thank you. And through the chair to Representative Eichheit, no, this section only applies to a motor vehicle dealer registered under AS 0866-010. So it's people that are in the practice, in the trade of selling used vehicles, they would have the duty to inspect. And I think that, if I may sort of opine as to why I think that there's a distinction there is, you know, they're likely buying the vehicle from a third party and they're transferring it. And therefore there's this an obligation to kind of inspect the vehicle that they're going to sell and make sure that it comports the safety requirements. A private seller, you know, if you know or have reason to know that you have a non-functioning airbag, that is what the written disclosure requirement would be for. So you could disclose that and that would protect you from liability under the sale. So I think that's why there's sort of a two-tiered system.
Follow up. So what if I don't know and I, as a private seller, I don't know and I haven't done a scan to determine whether that's happened where, you know, essentially like the airbags have been deployed and replaced prior to me buying the vehicle. So I have no knowledge, you know, so.
Right. Through the chair to Representative Eichheit. So the mens rea of the mental state element of the crime of airbag fraud, which has been broadened under this statute. So it was, you had to have actual knowledge to be held liable or to be criminally liable. Under the CS, you have to know or should have known. So it does have so if you have no reason to know that the airbag has previously been deployed, then you would not be criminally liable under the statute.
Thank you.
Representative Costello.
Thank you. And at some point, I'd like to know what the sponsor thinks of the committee substitute. But my question has to do with the propensity of deaths related to improper deployment of the airbags. Do we know that in Alaska?
Through the chair to Representative Costello, I would actually would defer to Mr. Goff on that one, in that I know that he has a more background knowledge on the deployment of airbags and some of the stats based on his research on the underlying bill.
Through the chair to Representative Costello, we did not have any cases in the state of Alaska currently of airbag fraud. It has become more of an issue in the lower 48 and with imports coming into the country as far as replacement airbags. And in our research, I know of two cases where there were defective airbags that went off that it was stated that the driver would have survived the accident without an airbag, but because the defective airbag went off, it actually lacerated their carotid artery and killed them at the scene. So I only know of two cases that I found in my research, and those were both in the lower 48.
Oh, I'll follow up on Representative Costello's question, because at the time that we were initially hearing the bill, that was really my question a lot, was how prevalent is this in Alaska? How much of a problem is this? How necessary is it that we create this crime? And what I was told at the time is that it is not a problem in Alaska, but it could be someday. This is just a forward-thinking bill to get out in front of it, like face masks, for example. Yes, Representative Mina.
Chair Gray, through the chair. So I recall some conversations with the sponsor of the Senate version of the bill that there is also some difficulty with enforcement of customs in related to airbag fraud because it's not a crime at all. That hasn't really been discussed in this committee. So I'm wondering if the bill sponsors could talk about that.
Through the chair to Representative Mina. This is David Goff, staff to Representative Tomaszewski. I don't recall anything on the customs enforcement. I think that it's the fact that it could be mailed from a foreign country and never go through a customs process, that these bags could get into the country or just brought across the border without being checked to begin with. So you could get defective parts that are being brought in without ever going through a customs agency as far as inspection.
Follow up through the chair. I guess I would love to know more background information if there is more that's out there related to the ability for customs or law enforcement to perhaps limit the ability for these fraudulent airbags to be sold. I understand that if you're an individual person buying them on the internet, you might be able to circumvent that process. But I think there might be a role just in terms of trying to limit the sale of these fraudulent airbags in our state. Thank you.
Through the chair, back to Representative Mina. I think that the bulk of these that are coming in are more in small quantities, like maybe one or two or three that are coming across in personal purchases or with people bringing over a few of them versus a large shipment coming across the border. But I will do some more research.
One thing I'll just point out for the committee is if you go to the original bill, you'll see a major difference between the CS and the original bill. The original bill said that the crime of airbag fraud does not apply to a person installing, reinstalling, or replacing an airbag on a vehicle used for police work. We took that out. Does not apply to an owner or employee of a motor vehicle dealership or the owner of a vehicle who before the sale of the vehicle does not have knowledge that the vehicle's airbag is counterfeit or non-functioning. We took that out. Like now, if you own a motor vehicle dealership, then you do actually have a role in doing an inspection to say like, yes, we know there's an airbag in there. We have every reason to believe it's the original airbag or whatever. The insurance company, we took that out. Insurance companies that transfer vehicles should not be exempt from this crime. And we also added the whole curing section again, like if you could sell I think I'll just remind folks, remember that the definition of a non-functioning airbag was a replacement airbag. So I think we've added that section to say that if it has a replacement airbag, you can just put it in writing, it has a replacement airbag. So that way, especially in Alaska, you can sell a vehicle even if it has a replacement airbag or if the airbag has been deployed previously. Does that make sense to people? Representative Vance.
I do have a couple of questions. In section one, you're talking about it requires a dealer to inspect, but then in section B, it says if they fail conduct an inspection and then they sell it, that they can be subject to civil penalties. And I'm wondering why you added both the selling, because typically a disclosure is required and the buyer can take the risk. This goes beyond that I'm not comfortable with, because people buy vehicles for a variety of different reasons. Maybe that safety inspection doesn't matter because they're going to address those. The other question is, why are they subject to civil penalties and then the other parts of the bill are criminal?
Mr. Hitchcock Lopez.
Through the chair to Representative Vance. So yes, to break the question down a little bit. So the duty to do an affirmative inspection for a used vehicle dealer is distinct from the criminal liability of the crime of airbag fraud. So it creates a duty to conduct a reasonable inspection and then says that if you don't conduct the inspection, yes, there'll be civil penalties. What's different about it, I think, from the criminal statute is first, there's not necessarily a harm that has occurred beyond the actual failure to inspect. So this would apply when the criminal statute wouldn't apply. No one has been harmed by this, but this is to make sure that the dealerships do what they're supposed to do. But to the other part of your question, as I read the statute here, the CS, it doesn't say that you can't sell the vehicle. We still have the safe harbor provision if the inspection should reveal that there's something wrong with the airbag. This just imposes an affirmative duty on the dealer to actually do that inspection. So they're related but slightly different harms here. One is the person who's in the business of actually buying and selling used cars to ensure that they are doing what they're supposed to do and do their due diligence to inspect those vehicles. Then the crime of airbag fraud, which is related but distinct because it has to really relates to what happens if somebody is harmed downstream. Does that kind of make sense, Representative?
It does. However, it feels like we're removing a buyer's discretion on what they are comfortable with. Disclosure appropriate. Mm-hmm. Hey, this, we checked it out. This doesn't work. And the buyer says, okay, I'm fine with that. But this looks like we are putting the dealer open to civil penalties even after they've done that disclosure and they sell the vehicle. At what point can someone come back and say, I'm going to file civilly?
Mr. Hitchcock Lopez.
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Vance. And thank you for the question. That makes more sense to me. I think that the way that that's addressed here is the civil penalty provision does not preclude the sale of the vehicle. That's what the disclosure requirement. So it's still – a buyer is still totally free to buy from the dealer, and the dealer is free to sell provided that they provide the disclosure. I think, though, if we think about it from this other perspective, because this provision applies to dealers in particular, if they don't have an affirmative duty to do an inspection, there would be no way of them necessarily knowing whether to disclose or not, right? And so this protects against the situation of because the crime of airbag fraud requires a mental state. Without the subsection that imposes the duty to inspect, a person in the business of dealing would just say, well, I just don't want to know, right? I will buy this vehicle from this person, and if I don't have any reason to believe that there's anything wrong with it, and then I turn around and sell it, then I couldn't be found liable at the crime of airbag fraud. So there has to be an affirmative duty for them to do an inspection. Then they can say, then they could say, yes, we did an inspection. This actually has a problem. You, buyer, are totally comfortable with it. You're going to, you want to fix it yourself. We'll do a written disclosure, and then nobody can be found liable at that point. That's how I think that the parts work together.
And I'll just add, in the hypothetical that you gave, if they have given a written disclosure that this vehicle contains a replacement airbag, the assumption is that they've done their due diligence. They conducted a reasonable inspection and they found that there was a replacement airbag, and they've notified you in writing that it's a replacement airbag. So you have taken on that risk as the buyer. Maybe you got it a little cheaper, you know, and the dealer doesn't have to worry about the civil penalty because they disclosed that it was a replacement airbag, possibly non-functioning.
Follow up. So what about, are we eliminating the as-is provision where a dealer could say, hey, I got this vehicle in, we're selling it as-is. We haven't taken a look at, we haven't examined anything. Someone just wants to sell it. Are we, by this bill, eliminating that option for commerce?
I think the title of the bill is the crime of airbag fraud. And we were talking about, Mr. Goff brought up the section of a faulty airbag severing someone's carotid artery. And I think that what we're trying to do is prevent accidents like that from happening. And that's what the whole purpose of the bill is, to try to make cars safer. So I think, yeah, you're right. We're putting something on the dealer. We're saying you can't just sell a completely faulty car without doing your due diligence and doing a simple inspection. We are saying you have to do that. But it's in order to maybe protect human life. I think that that's what the overall goal of the bill is. So I don't think that we're placing an undue burden on the dealer to do an inspection and disclose something if needed. But that's my perspective as the sponsor of the CS, I guess. Representative Mina?
Through the chair to the both sponsor and staff, so do car dealerships do inspections for all of their cars before they sell?
This is David Goff, staff to Rep. Tomaszewski. I do not know if they do inspections on every vehicle.
Through the chair, follow up. I would love to follow up to see if that is required in law or what dealerships usually do just in terms of car inspections. Thank you.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Representative Mita asked a good question. You know, I do know, having bought a few Toyotas, that if you buy the Toyota certified, that's what they're certified, yep, is all the maintenance, that the safety inspection. There's quite a list,
right,
that they give you indicating that they are assuming liability, selling you this car, that all those things are working. But as we all know, there are thousands of cars sold in Alaska every year that aren't certified to any standard of inspection. And that's why they say as is right on the window sticker. Mm-hmm. And they'll say anything, you know, beyond what it looks like, we can't really speak to. So this would certainly address a requirement in that area. I have one follow-up question, Mr. Trent, just maybe for you, Mr. Goff. Is there any issue with sales, purchase, operation, transactions that's going on in Alaska right now with respect to airbags that this legislation is addressing, or is this, is there an entity or a group of people here in state that would like to see this passed that's in this industry? I guess that's what I'm saying.
For the record, David Goff, staff to Rep. Tomaszewski, through the chair to Rep. Kopp. At this time, no, there's not an active group, but I did start to see some, it was kind of interesting. I did just see a couple of commercials this weekend talking about airbag fraud across the nation and saying that legislation needs to be in place. It was just kind of out of the blue that this came up, and I was like, oh.
Yeah. It's like a good idea. I'll draft a bill.
Yeah.
Right. Gotcha. Okay.
Thank you, Representative Kopp. At this time, we'd like to call up Representative Tomaszewski to offer his opinion about the CS.
Thank you, Chair Gray and the committee. For the record, Representative Frank Tomaszewski. So as far as the CS, I know there are some provisions in there that that I haven't completely and thoroughly vetted and had counsel on. Whether they should have known, that's a statement in there that's kind of up in the air. I don't know exactly how that plays out legally, whether they should have known. And as far as there's been some other questions about whether this is prevalent in Alaska. And, you know, I think at some point it will become when somebody who is driving around in with a bad airbag and hits a moose, they will find out that their airbag wasn't working. And so I think this is a kind of a step to get out in front of the problem that obviously is coming towards us. You know, we in Alaska here are a little bit more isolated from the rest of the nation. I know a lot of this activity comes into larger population centers, right? And you will see these kinds of frauds happening, and it'll slowly trickle its way up into Alaska. And so that's why we kind of tried to address this.
Thank you. Any Representative Mina?
Chair Gray, I actually have a question. It might be for Mr. Hitchcock Lopez. Going back to the committee substitute, so it looks like you're changing the crime if it results in serious physical injury to a Class C felony, or a Class B felony. So could you talk about just the changes in terms of the felonies from the original version to the committee substitute?
Thank you. Dylan Jacques Lopez, committee aide, through the chair to Representative Mina. So the way I believe the original bill was structured, it was a Class A misdemeanor that was elevated to a Class C felony if death or serious physical injury to another person resulted from the prohibited conduct, the airbag fraud. This just breaks it out further. So now it's a Class A misdemeanor is the base offense. It's a Class C felony if serious physical injury occurs, and it's a Class B felony if death occurs. So it enhances the crime to a B felony if it results in death.
Follow up through the chair. Let's say if there was the sale and then someone died, could that person also be charged with manslaughter on top of this crime?
So, and through the chair to Representative Mina, yes, and it would depend on the circumstances, but manslaughter is a reckless mental state. It's the reckless disregard of the risk of a death occurring. And so as a matter of kind of common practice, oftentimes you will see, you know, I think we had this conversation in depth with respect to another bill that was here in front of the committee not long ago, but, you know, oftentimes you'll see levels of offense resulting in death charged as lesser included offenses of one another when the conduct could arguably fall into one category or another. But that would be what would distinguish it from manslaughter.
Thank you. And just another follow-up through the chair to Mr. Hitchcock Lopez. I know you mentioned it before, but could you explicitly explain the difference between the mens rea in this version by adding the phrase should know?
Yes, through the chair to Representative Mina, Dylan Jacques Lopez, committee aide, and if have the committee's indulgence for 1 second to find the specific line.
Page 2, line 15.
Thank you.
Through the chair.
Thank you. So through the chair to Representative Mina, this creates what's called a constructive knowledge element. So, you know, if you know something, this would be that, you know, that you have knowledge that the airbag is a replacement or counterfeit or non-functioning airbag. By adding known or should have known, that means that if the person is on notice that it is, that a reasonable person in that person's situation would be aware, then they can also be held liable. So this is where, you know, you have situations in the law where someone's disregard of a fact is unreasonable, that a reasonable person in their situation would have known. They can't say, well, I didn't actually know that this was the case because, I turned a blind eye and I ignored it, even though I actually, you know, if I had been behaving reasonably, I would be aware of it. So they're a kind of difficult situation sometimes to pinpoint, but it's too going sort of in counterpart to some of the inspection requirements. It's really to ensure that there is not an incentive structure for people to behave unreasonably and fail to act as good custodians of their vehicles or to engage in best practices because they might escape liability if they just sort of turn a blind eye to bad conduct. So it's in order to ensure that the incentive structures are there for people to exercise best practices.
Thank you.
Representative Eichheim.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, I think this is a question for the sponsor. I don't remember if this was discussed last year, or it was said while I was looking at all my materials, but is there any data that shows in Alaska an average year how many folks are killed on our roads in an automobile accident where the vehicle had an airbag? And this is a really broad question because frontal airbags don't necessarily deploy if you have a transverse or sideways hit. But just how many – do we have any data? How many folks die in Alaska every year because they were in a vehicle with an airbag that did not deploy for whatever reason? Just real basic.
Through the chair, this is Representative Frank Tomaszewski for the record. I do not have those statistics as to how many people are injured or die each year due to motor vehicle crashes. I know when I was in a head-on collision with my family, I had more airbags come out of the vehicle than I even knew existed. There were curtain walls, and it was amazing to me the amount of airbags. And definitely probably saved some serious injuries by them being functional. And so, you know, but I'm not exactly sure how many people each year in Alaska.
Yeah, thank you. I have a follow-up on Representative Eichheit's question. When all of your airbags deployed, are you still driving that vehicle now?
No, that vehicle was absolutely destroyed. And it was a Suburban, so this is a very large vehicle, and we had a unfortunate head-on collision with an impaired driver on my way to Anchorage, and that vehicle is definitely it was towed away, and I never saw it again.
That was my. I called mechanics after last year's hearings. And to do my due diligence. And what I heard over and over is when a bunch of airbags deploy, it's real hard to fix that car and to put those airbags back and to make it a vehicle that someone would buy or that something that would even drive. And there was also, I don't know if you can comment, was there one mechanic I spoke with talked about sort of powder going all over the vehicle when the airbag deploys and it's really hard to get the powder out of the car. Like the detailing is very difficult. Did you notice that?
No, I didn't. At the time, I did not notice. I did not notice that. I just thought, wow, we're going to burn up here because it felt like we were on fire and I was just trying to get the door open and get everybody out. So,
well, I'm glad that it worked for you. I'm glad those airbags went off and that you were safe. Yeah. But I guess my follow-up question is I would be curious to know how often airbags deploy in vehicles in Alaska and those vehicles are able to be made for resale.
And I believe there are a lot because, you can total a vehicle just by hitting something solid in very cold weather and the whole front end falls off a car, right? And then the insurance company will just total that vehicle. Well, then somebody buys that vehicle, right? And they restore it. And hopefully they're putting in a good and reasonably and a functioning airbag.
Well, I'd be interested to know more about that, Representative Tomaszewski, because I've totaled my vehicles before in situations like that, but my airbags didn't deploy. So, right, because if you don't slam into something, I didn't need my airbag to deploy. I have completely crushed the front of my vehicle without my airbags deploying because there's a certain amount of force required for that airbag deployment. So I believe you that there are lots of vehicles declared totaled that then get sold and are on our roads. But I'm very curious about the specific vehicles where the airbags deployed and they were able to close it back up and resell that vehicle. I want to know how many of those we're talking about, because that thing is relevant to the bill. Representative Costello. Oh,
really sorry to hear about that again. I know this must be very devastating. My question has to do with the original version of the bill on page 2 says that the section does not apply to, and then it goes on to say, a person who transfers the vehicle to the insurance company to satisfy a claim that it's an actual total loss. So now the new version would, I imagine, keep that owner of the car liable, if even if you had to relinquish your car to the insurance company because it was a total loss. So can you talk about the difference between version that you introduced and the committee substitute that removes that?
I don't know if we've discussed that.
No, through, for the record, David Goff, staff to Rep. Tomaszewski. I think that might be a question for the committee staff, if you looked at that.
Thank you, Mr. Hitchcock Lopez. And it, the relevant section is on of the CS, page 2, lines 19 through 22.
Thank you, Dylan Hitchcock Lopez, committee aide. Through the chair to Representative Costello. So I believe that the intent of the CS is not to create liability for that person, the person whose vehicle has been damaged in a car and then they're selling it to the insurance company. And I think that the way that the CS attempts to handle that issue is it creates the general safe harbor provision in the lines just quoted by the chair, which is a person just needs to disclose in writing that their vehicle airbags are non-functioning. And then it also builds in section 3 their specific disclosures related to insurance companies to allow the insurance company to dispose of the vehicle in a way that just, as long as they comport with the notice requirements there, then liability shouldn't be an issue for the insurance company either. So again, the intent was not to criminalize that conduct, but was to sort of bake those protections into the disclosure requirements, sort of in a more holistic sense.
So, sorry, the way I read it, it says that the disclosure deals with a counterfeit or non-functioning airbag. And so I guess, you know, in my mind, what's happening now? You know, if you buy a car that's been in an accident, is there a disclosure there? And that would obviously or could include information about the airbag. I'm not sure why you would take that part out when it specifically says that it doesn't apply to that owner of that car, because after you've been through a horrific accident, I think the last thing on your mind is going to be filling out a form that says your airbag's deployed.
Representative Costello, I'm open to your amendment. We're not intending for you after an accident to do any of that. We were really talking about the insurance company. The way we read the original bill was as providing some protection to the insurance company that we didn't want there. We wanted the insurance company. If an insurance company is reselling a totaled vehicle, we wanted some onus on that insurance company to guarantee that that formerly totaled vehicle was safe to drive and in reference to the airbag. So that's what we were going for. But if you have ways of making that clearer in our CS, I think we're very open to that change, because I really want to make it so that insurance companies can't sell dangerous totaled vehicles and get immunity. That's what I didn't want, or what we were trying to go for, I think. Mr. Hitchcock Lopez.
And through the chair to Representative Costello, I think that some of the ambiguity may also be that it's sort of unclear to me whether the person whose vehicle has been destroyed and then their vehicle is being declared a total loss is really a seller of a vehicle as contemplated by the crime. So it may just be a clerical change to the CS to make very clear that that person is not a seller, as that's not really the type of transaction that is meant to be captured by this CS.
I will also mention that last year when we were talking about this bill, I did contact Alaska Mechanics and I asked questions about, do you install counterfeit airbags? And they didn't even understand the question. They said that they get their airbags from manufacturers directly, that there's not like the whole, because we had heard that there was this like black market of Chinese airbags with t-shirts in them that were very, very cheap, and that there was like a margin to be made by not buying the official airbag, but buying this cheaper Chinese counterfeit. And at least in my two phone calls to Anchorage Mechanics, they really did not understand what I was talking about. And they said that in the grand scheme of things, that would not be where they would be trying to make up a margin of $100 or so. They're like, that's not how we would try to like cut a corner. So again, I think when we're talking about the crime of counterfeit airbags, we really would be talking about somebody who was knowingly installing a cheaper counterfeit airbag. And at least from my couple of phone calls, that was not something that mechanics were familiar with. Seeing, yes, Representative Costello.
I would just like to put on the record that I really like on page 2, lines 6 through 23, that actually say this section does not apply. And I understand that in law, when you're drafting something, that you can either do it that way or you can avoid having to do it that way by just addressing the situation. But I did like that section in the original
version.
Yeah, just want to put that on the record.
Thank you. So Representative Costello, can you speak to why you liked police vehicles being exempted, for example?
Well, I guess I'm speaking more to the fact that it states the section does not apply to, and it includes lines 12 through 14 we were just talking about. Mm-hmm. I would probably like more information on why that was included in the original version about the police work. I am curious about that part of it.
Okay. Representative Cobb.
Yeah, just a speculation, but for patrol and any special crime watch or crime response teams, the cars are often used as physical blockade devices to box people in, to disable vehicles. And so to maybe to Representative Costello's point, those airbags may have been activated repeatedly, and I don't know that it's the department policies. Now we'd have to ask, you know, the officials to always replace them. But those cars are abused. Let me just say, you know, for everything from side impacts, boxing people in, doing pit maneuvers where you're making a vehicle lose its inertia, going in a straight line, spinning out of control, and then box it in. And so my guess is, I didn't see the original version, but my guess is if it was in there, it probably was to relieve a municipality of liability for its patrol fleet, because they do, when the cars get 150,000, whatever miles, they'll sell them off. Mm-hmm. And maybe there was municipality testimony about not wanting to be drawn in. I don't know. I don't know the background.
Well, I will explain why I took it out. Because if I'm buying a vehicle from the police department that's been abused in that way, I think we should be disclosed that these airbags may not work. I think that that's a fair written disclosure for somebody who's buying that vehicle from the police department to have. I don't think the police department should have like carte blanche exemption for the crime of airbag fraud. It just...
Sometimes the spotlight and the push bumper and the cage aren't enough of an indicator. Right.
Thank you. Are there any other questions about the CS?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Vance.
In Section 1, it encompasses more than just airbags. It talks about an inspection over the safety systems.
that includes airbags, seatbelts, crash sensors, and related components to be functioning properly. I feel like this is much broader than just airbags. And my concern here is that this the statute that's referenced, AS08.66.010, is every type of motor vehicle dealer. And I feel like this is going to impose added costs onto types of dealers that sell as is. That, you know, full disclosure, my brother is a Jeep guru, and he buys Jeeps that have been totaled, and he does a full repair. He buys them for parts. He buys them. My Jeep was one that was totaled. And the last time we had this bill, I texted him, and like, the airbag works, right? But he goes, yeah, it wasn't deployed in the type of the crash that it was in. But it was enough that he knew, but he bought it as is because it saves money, and then was able to go and rebuild it because he has the capability to do so. And I feel like this is going to increase cost on small business owners. My brother's not a dealer. However, this encompasses every type of dealer who is then going to have to do a full-on inspection and make sure that they get that up to speed. And while I want people to be safe, the libertarian-minded side of me says, are we imposing more regulatory costs, more burden, that we aren't fully aware of what the ramifications are? I'd like to know more about what the impacts of this are going to be, since it's going beyond just airbags. Mm-hmm. And maybe we can get an understanding of that, especially since we're increasing the crimes.
Thank you, Representative Vance. So do you prefer the original version of the bill?
I haven't made a decision yet.
Okay.
there's a lot of components here that I think are that we haven't fully comprehended from either the original version or especially this new version yet to really make a decision.
Okay. Anyways, can we? Back on the record, seeing no additional questions, I remove my objection. Are there any other objections?
I will object, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you. Would you like to speak to your objection?
Sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Would you like to?
No, I think I did just a moment ago.
Okay, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Koch.
Pass.
This is to adopt the CS.
As our working document.
Yes.
Representative Mina.
Yes.
Representative Vance.
No.
Representative Costello.
Yes.
Representative Underwood.
No.
Representative Cox.
Yes.
Representative Costello.
No.
Chair Gray.
Yes.
Four yeas, three nays.
With a vote of four yeas and three nays, the committee substitute for House Bill 74 has been adopted as the working document. Are there any other further questions or comments for the sponsor of House Bill 74?
Uh,
Thank you, Chair Gray and the committee for hearing the bill. We appreciate all the great questions and dialogue that took place today and look forward to seeing where this bill goes in the future.
Thank you. Representative Cobb?
I was just going to thank the bill sponsor for bringing it forward.
Oh. Yeah. Thank you, bill sponsor, for bringing this forward. We will set at ease. Back on the record, we will now set House Bill 74 aside and bring it up at a later date. That concludes today's business before the House Judiciary Committee. Before we adjourn, here's a preview of our upcoming meetings. On Wednesday, March 18th, we will hear HJR 43, Voter Privacy, sponsored by this committee. We will hear HJR 31, Constitutional Amendment, Corporations and Rights by Representative Fields, and HJR 41, Rescind Requirement for Constitutional Convention, Representative Strage. On Friday, March 20th, we will hear HJR 23, Constitutional Amendment, Governor's Proposed Budget by Representative Underwood, and HB 367, Consumer Data Privacy Act by Representative Story. The time is now 3:01 p.m., and this hearing of the House Judiciary Committee is adjourned.